Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, we are back here with Pachinko coverage. My name is Ariel, and this is Pachinko episodes 5 through 8. I am not alone. Thankfully, I am joined by my friend, Soon. Soon, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing, Ariel?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for asking. I'm so thrilled to be back talking about Pachinko, a beautiful show. It's the end of the first season. Thankfully, we have the very exciting news that it's going to be back for season 2 at some point. So that bodes well for the show. You know, clearly Apple TV isn't struggling as much as Netflix seems to be at the moment. Yeah, season 1 is over. And I guess before we get into, the more nitty gritty details, how did you feel about the season overall? And the second half, especially.
I was pleasantly entertained, but definitely not a comedy for sure. I mean, I think you have to be, you have to be emotionally prepared for what you're going into. So I think people who obviously have read the book and enjoyed the book know what's in store for them.
Right.
And I think it's really well done. I mean, I mentioned this last time, but I started the audiobook at the same time.
Yeah.
And I mean, definitely more in the book because they're splitting the show into multiple seasons, so they're not giving everything away.
Right.
But knowing some of the details that are described in the book while watching the show, it's a good like complimentary thing to kind of like read or absorb at the same time when you're watching it, because there are a lot of gaps that don't really get explained in the show that you kind of fill it in as you're going along if you know the book or reading it. But you don't want to give away spoilers for friends who are just watching the show. So it's good that they're having a second season, because hopefully they will get into some of the other parts of the book. And I don't know how many seasons are planning to stretch.
Yeah, I think at some point they said like 3 to 4 seasons. Like, I know you and I talked about this a little bit before this, of like the book is kind of broken up into like 3 parts, right? Or like 3 books within the larger book. But I had heard at least that it was a multi-season plan. So it seems like maybe they'll do, I mean, we talked a little about this last time of like the book is told in completely chronological order, whereas obviously the show is kind of skipping around and showing us like multiple generations. So, you know, obviously it's not a one-to-one adaptation, but, yeah, it sounds like they had a multi-season plan at least, which makes, you know, it's more than two. So I would say at least three, so that, you know, that bodes well for the show.
I really hope they end up creating their own storylines in season three then, because it's a pretty depressing story. I'm not done with the book yet.
Right.
I'm on the last 3 hours of the audiobook, but they're starting they'll come full circle right at the end. It will end with Solomon. Like, that's not a spoiler, guys. Like, it's probably going to end with Solomon's story because he is that last generation that they're
right. The yeah, since the book is told chronologically, yeah, it makes sense. It would be Solomon to close it out.
So I can't imagine them stretching out whatever they left out in season one through seasons three and four. That seems kind of, I don't know, but I don't write the show, so
right. Will... right, that's right. We are not here to write the show. We are here to talk about the show. But that makes sense what you said. I think, you know, if it's three longer or three seasons, you know, this is 8 episodes. They can do 8 or 10 episodes for the rest of the seasons, and they can fill it all. The episodes aren't short.
Yeah, you know, they just run with it. Like, you don't have to stay true to the book, right? You can start off with it and then be inspired, and maybe they'll get into Solomon's story more, and then there'll be, you know, future generations of that. I mean,
right.
Definitely not gonna, it's not gonna follow Hana because, you know.
Oh no, R.I.P. Hana.
R.I.P. Hana.
We'll get to that. But yeah, now you got me thinking, oh God, are they gonna do like, you know, stuff beyond the book of like Solomon's kids and, you know, other generations to make like a broader point? But that would feel a little bit, you know. I think it would make sense to me that we're staying for the most part within the parameters of the timeline that we have already established and kind of playing around in the middle, and not that they would like stretch it in the other direction, but who's to say?
Well, it would be really interesting if they kind of branched out to Kohanzu and the story of his children, because he has 3 daughters, and the theme of this book show is supposed to be about the women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, no, that's true. That's definitely a big part of it. But yeah, I thought, you know, we talked about it last time already again, but the music is so beautiful. Like I talk on other podcasts a lot about, you know, soundtrack and scores and how much of a fan I am of just how much of an appreciation really I have for music specifically and how it's utilized in TV and movies. And here, this is just, it's so epic in scale. Like, it feels larger than life, and the way it's shot is so beautiful, and it really was just like kind of firing on all cylinders by the end, as far as like the emotion that it was evoking and what it was trying, the points that it was trying to get across. And now that we had set up all the stuff in the first 4 episodes, they could really just play around with all the different pieces that they had, you know, kind of created in the sandbox.
I have a question.
Yes.
Speaking of the music.
Uh-huh.
At what point did they change the theme song?
Okay, so you know that I noticed this because I'm a big fan of the opening credits dancing.
And I was not. So, and then I noticed it on the last episode. I was like, wait, what happened? The music's different.
Well, I actually know what happened. The first 4 episodes were the regular song, or I think they might have started in episode 2, but episodes 5 and 6 were the regular, you know, opening credit song that we had already heard. Then episode 7, which was the flashback episode, we got no song. We got like just the card. I don't know if that was, I mean, it couldn't have been about length because that episode was less than an hour. So maybe it had more to do with like the emotion, since it was like a super flashback. They're like, we're not going to show the family. And then the last one, they changed the music and used the song that was not in English. And it was like had some lyrics in English, but then other lyrics in Korean, I believe. So really the answer is in the last episode, but they kind of also changed it in the second to last episode. Because even when I'm, you know, like zooming by it a little bit. I don't skip it, but sometimes I fast forward if I'm in a rush. And I noticed, I was like, this is different. What's going on? Did they change it? So yeah, that's the answer to your question. And maybe in season two, that'll be more of a thing where they play around with, you know, different kinds of opening credits. I don't know. I missed the original one. Did you miss the dancing?
No. So, you know, last time we talked about this, I said, I didn't really, I wasn't a big fan of it.
Right.
So the last episode was watching, you know, the opening, mm-hmm. you know.
Right. The opening credits.
No, not the, well, you watch like the opening
of the episode, right. The cold open. Right.
Yeah. The scene. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into the, and I was ready to fast mm-hmm. forward, like skip mm-hmm. intro. And then I noticed the music was different. And I asked myself, wait, did they change it? Did I? Because I always skip through it. So I don't
right.
Really
you were caught
notice.
Looking. You're like, wait a minute. Is this
okay,
what
so
I
I'm glad this wasn't different? Something that happened in episode 5.
No, that you like had missed for a
and
bunch
was late
of episodes.
To the party.
No.
Okay.
No. That it really was just for the end. But yeah, I'm really happy with it. It was super evocative. I cried a whole bunch. As you said, it's, you know, it's heavy at times, but it is very beautifully told, very beautifully rendered. You know, you do have, in my opinion anyway, you do have a really good sense of all the characters, certainly by the end of the season, a lot of their motivations and what they've been through. And it just feels so, so rich, even though some of the characters are not. Sorry for that joke. So I guess let's get into it. We can just go into some, you know, nitty gritty spoiler territory. You know, I guess it goes without saying, but spoiler alert for episode 5-3, if you haven't watched it, don't listen unless you don't care to be spoiled. And in that case,
or you know, if you haven't read the book,
right? That's true. Right. Light spoilers from the book. So I'm sure soon we'll once again, like last time, be intercutting with some, that was different from the book kind of stuff. But I think that's helpful and adds some color to the commentary. So yeah, episode 5, we have old Sunja and she's happy to be home. Because remember at the end of episode 4, she was like on the beach. She had finally returned to Korea and it had been so long. And especially in light of her sister's death, it like really hit home for her that she, you know, she's running out of time and she needs to get home. And that is intercut with young Sunja arriving in Japan for the first time when she first left Korea. So I thought that was like a very interesting and wise choice. Like we talked a little bit last time about episode 4 kind of feels like a mini finale, and episode 5 with that kind of beginning kind of feels like a mini premiere of like, look, it's full circle. She's coming back home. And also, let's see when she first arrived at the other place. So there is like this mirror arrival that I think is really cool.
Like, yeah, the first 4 episodes could have been season 1.
Yeah, or like season 1A, right? Like Netflix would release like in June, they released the first 4. And then in July, they released the next 4.
Yeah. And there was a point where you thought, oh my God, is she going to drown herself in the ocean? There's a lot of ways that could have gone.
At the end of 4, you asked me that, I remember, yeah. Mr. Jones said, well, we see here that she survived, and she's very happy. Not only did she survive, she's very happy to be in the old marketplace, or, you know, in her old marketplace, and she's so excited to see all the, you know, different kinds of fish and whatever that they're selling, and she buys all the things, and her son, who we hadn't met before, as far as I can remember, right, because obviously he lives there, or at least not at this age, we had met him.
Muzazu? Well, that's Solomon's dad. So we meet him when Solomon first comes
right.
back
we first met
to
him
Japan.
At the very beginning. Right.
Because
right.
he's the pachinko
yes.
man.
He's the pachinko man, yeah, of the aforementioned pachinko, that's right. And so he's really happy. She's really happy to be back. So young Sunja is meeting her brother-in-law for the first time, which is, you know, obviously the brother of her husband. And we meet her new sister-in-law, who is so sweet. I feel like she's my, like, she's not my favorite character, but she's my favorite new character that we've met in the, like, this batch of episodes. She's so sweet to Sunja and, like, so just thoughtful. And when she gives her the rice and Sunja cries, like, I cried. We already talked a lot at length last time about the significance of the rice and why it meant a lot to her and her mom and all that. And here, here she gets the rice and it makes her cry. And that's what gets us into the opening credits for this first episode. So we go to Solomon, who is still reeling from the fiasco at the bank. And he has a conversation with his coworker, Naomi. They kind of have like this is kind of the end of their not relationship, I guess, just friendship, because they're kind of like snippy with each other, where he's like, oh, it must be really hard being a woman at a bank where everybody hates you. And she's kind of like, yeah, good luck to you. You effed yourself over, you know, by letting that deal go south. I was kind of sad to like that they had like a falling out here a little bit.
That's because Solomon is emotionally mature and is just not, you know, he just doesn't want to hear what she has to say. She's not wrong.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, she's just another strong woman stating opinion, but mostly fact that, you know, that was a choice that he made, right? So he just needs to live with it. What he did wasn't wrong, right?
Right, right.
But then later he goes on and blames his grandmother for, you know, making him do the things that he did. And that's
pathetic, right? Empathy. Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, and at that point when he's arguing with his grandmother, or when he's talking to her, you know, that's like a bad faith argument of like, you know, you made me do this. Because you're right, he made his own decision and he's an adult, and that's how it goes. And you don't get to like blame somebody else for the decision that you made. So, you know, going back in time, young Sunjo has now arrived at the new house, and her brother and sister-in-law are like talking shit about her, like right next door. And, like, the walls are not thin. So basically it seems like Sunja and her husband can just hear everything they're saying about her. And obviously they're judging her because she's very far along in her pregnancy, which means that it's probably not Isaac's baby. Or at least it's suspicious in some way. And they're being very judgy here.
Well, if the walls are that thin, I'm sure they could have also heard them boning later in the night.
Right after this. Yeah, it's really funny because like that's the answer, not like let's go to sleep quietly. It's like, well, we might as well have some fun. And it is, you know, yes, they have sex, but it is like a very tender moment, certainly the way it starts out. Where,
oh, way more than like any, you know, relations that she was having with Kohansi, right? They were just like, let's just do it in the woods.
Yes, right. Laundry, yes, that's what the kids are calling it now. We're going to do laundry.
Let's go do laundry. You know, her relationship, I think she ends up genuinely caring for and loving Isaac, right? Which, and vice versa. And it is what, you know, and he raises someone else's kid as his own. Like, that ended up being more of a actual relationship and a marriage and a family than, you know, anything else. And I'm sorry, Yosef's not my favorite person. The brother-in-law.
Yeah, he's just, I mean, to your point a little bit, to your point previously about Solomon, he's a little bit just emotionally immature, where he's just like, and he's the kind of more so like also like stunted emotionally. Like, he's kind of like a man child.
He is so much worse than the book. Just putting that out there.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he's right up there with Hana. Like, those two, probably my least two favorite characters on the show, in the book. Just not good people. Selfish, whiny. Yeah,
your favorite.
Not my least two favorite people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's definitely my least favorite of all four of these. Like, in the two couples, he's just like, you know, his wife is so warm and lovely, and like it definitely hit me really powerfully, like how sweet she was, and I just appreciate her so much from like Sunja's perspective. And by comparison, he's just like a total dirtbag, basically.
He is, and you know, when you had said like Kyunghee, which is her sister-in-law, like she was one of your favorites, I definitely rolled my eyes. You saw me, because I felt like she was a little bit. Everything, you know, whenever Sunja would want to go do something, Kingy would be all afraid of, you know, what her husband would think, you know, and I don't feel like that was a sign of a healthy relationship. Right. I know that was the way it was supposed to be back then. Like, wives are supposed to obey their husbands and listen to them. But I feel like that made Kyung Hee like a weak person, even though deep down inside she wasn't, and she was just a sweethearted, you know, woman.
Right.
He was just kind of, I mean, no wonder she was like that, because he was kind of a jerk. And, yeah. You know, I'm sorry, you know, when they pay off his debt, even though ultimately he took out that loan to support his second son, Jae, to come to Japan, you know, like, they're just trying to, you know, pay him back for this. And he just kind of threw a shit fit and went to the bar and got drunk while Sunja was in labor and her husband,
we'll get to that. Yeah. But it's not a good look. It's just like on the list of things that he does. I mean, we can continue, you know, we can continue down the storyline basically, but yeah, to your point, there is, you know, there is a level of like autonomy and independence and intelligence and confidence that Sunja has that her sister-in-law is basically eventually openly kind of jealous of, or like envious of is maybe a better word. Because she just doesn't see herself in that way. And she's like, she assessed her, you know, you make me feel foolish basically, because, you know, you have all this power and like you just wield it. And we saw the opening scenes, or not the very opening, but very early on, even in the first episode when Sunja's very young, we see that side of her with her dad in the marketplace, and she's like snappy and she's charismatic and, you know, people really respond to her. So when Sunja sees that there are these men who come to the house and like are asking them for money, and this is just, it's just Sunja and her sister-in-law at the house, so, you know, these men are trying to like come in and demand money, it's like, whoa, get out of here. She decides that she's gonna take the watch that her baby daddy gave her, and she's gonna, they basically go to like a pawn shop, right? And they, you know, he's gonna pay, they haggle on price, and this is like a really weird thing where he's only willing to pay her like, I think it was like less than a, it was somewhere less than 100, and then they jump up, they agree on like, he offers 225, and then she agrees. She's like, no, 300 final offer. And then like he eventually does pay her. We kind of see at the end of the episode that it seems like part of the reason that he was willing to pay her that much is because of Hanzo's meddling, Hanzo's meddling, but still good on her for being like, no deal, you know, like, sorry, that's not happening. Or, you know, until she heard the price that she wanted, which was the amount of money that they needed to settle this debt. Because otherwise, why the hell are we doing this? And this is when her sister-in-law is like, oh my God, you're so much more badass than me, basically.
No, it's, I think Kyung Hee's like the not the stereotypical, she is the model of the perfect obedient wife, right?
Yes, right.
And Sunja is a survivor, so she'll do whatever it takes to survive, because she's lived this, you know, very hard, you know, life of poverty almost, you know, growing up, and, you know, having, you know, her father die at a young age, and then being separated from her mother, you know, getting pregnant, moving to a foreign country where she doesn't know anything or anyone. And then Kyung Hee was like, This was in the show. Sometimes now I get confused.
You get confused between the universes.
Like, did this happen in the book, or did this happen on the show? But Kyung Hee was, you know, she basically told Sunja, I never cooked for myself or did anything. You know, she was raised in this life, you know, obviously more well-to-do in Korea, and didn't have to do the things to survive like Sunja did. So, of course, she's going to be so impressed by, you know, Sunja's strength and her confidence and her resilience and her willingness to not back down to men, especially, right?
No, because that's rule number one as far as Sunja's concerned. Like, do not. So, staying on Sunja, going back to older Sunja now, she takes her sister's ashes and they spread it in the sea, you know, in the middle of the water. And then she wants to go visit the burial site of her father, because obviously she hasn't been back in a long time. And then they go, and it's a parking lot now, which sucks, like to say the least. It's like, oh no, of all things, a parking lot. It seems very impersonal and shitty. And of course, she's upset. Who wouldn't be? But luckily, they go to the DMV type place of where you would go to find out like the information of where the, you know, burial site would have potentially been moved. You know, it's been a long time apparently, but there is. They talk to the woman and basically they get a name of someone that was linked to her father, and it ends up being her. Not her biological sister, but one of the women that lived at the boarding house, right?
With the her two sisters that was living with her, right? that she used to do laundry with.
She used to do laundry with, not in air quotes, but when she was doing air quotes laundry with Hanzu. Yeah, this is such a sweet moment because see, like, they don't reckon. Of course, she doesn't recognize Sunja because it's been forever. They both look like completely different people, but they get to like talk about themselves or talk about, you know, their history, and Sunja finds out some stuff about her mom and like how her mom passed. You know, basically they're reminiscing, and you know, Sunja gets to hear information that she wasn't privy to. But more importantly, she knows where the father is buried now, thankfully. So she's able to go to the burial site and pay respects to her father.
So did they dig up all the people who were buried in that parking lot and relocate them?
I mean, they had to, right? Like, yeah, absolutely. It sucks. It just makes it that much more disrespectful that, like, of all, like, at least they didn't, like, pave over it. Like, they have done, like, in some effed up historical examples, you know, all over the world. It's like, wow, we uprooted the school and we find, like, all these, you know, bodies of what, you know, it's horrible to even consider. But, yes, it seems like they did literally the minimum good thing that they could have done and like moved the bodies to a new place. So this is, you know, this is her quote unquote like happy ending for the episode.
You know what's weird? I'm just gonna give you a little side story.
Yeah, here.
So for culture, you know, especially Asian culture, everyone is just very obsessed with, you know, being respectful of your elders and the dead, and you know, every anniversary of someone's death or birthdays, whatever, you know, we set the table for, you know, the person who's passed and just kind of have like a moment to kind of honor them. And, you know, my grandfather, my mom's dad, you know, passed away when I was very young. I think I was around 5. And, you know, they buried him. But, you know, since then, like, she hasn't been able to go out there to see his grave. And my grandmother came here and then she passed and we cremated her. So my mom actually wants to go to Korea, have them dig up my grandfather and cremate him, like, whatever's left, his bones, cremate him so she can bring him back here and put his ashes next to my grandmother. In theory, yes, it's sweet. I don't know what to call it.
Obviously, the intention is pure, good, right? Pure, good.
Right? But very creepy and disturbing. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So
yeah, I would have trouble disturbing that personally.
So going, you know, now that I think about the whole parking lot situation and them digging up all the people who are buried there and relocating them, maybe that's not so fucked up now because mm-hmm. my mom literally proposed this idea not too long ago. So
right.
You know.
Yeah. I guess you'll see what happens on that front.
I'll let you guys know what happens with my grandfather's.
Right. Right. Cause it's like firsthand experience. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, in these cases of like, you know, moving around places in the world and living in other places than you had lived a long time ago, things like this come up. It's like a very, it's a somewhat unique problem. So, I guess real quickly, we can go through just Solomon's story in this episode. He goes looking. He gets the phone call from at the end of last episode or previous episodes. He was getting calls from Hannah. And in this episode, he goes looking for her. in a place that he got a tip that she might be around, and he meets a childhood friend who he doesn't recognize at first, and then he goes to the childhood friend's house and he shares like a very sweet meal, and they're all kind of like happy to see him and they're impressed, and you know, the head of that household knows his dad, knows Solomon's dad, so it's like, you know, it's that thing of like, we know each other, and even though we haven't seen each other in a long time, there's just like the shared history. And obviously that family that Solomon is visiting isn't as quote unquote well off as like Solomon is or as his family is. And then there's this moment at the end where he basically tries to give him money because Solomon doesn't really know how else to like be. He's like, here, this money will solve, like, it says a lot about him, right? To your point earlier about like Solomon being, you know, a little bit on the immature side. He's like, here's money. Like, I don't know what to say to you or how to help you. This is all I can offer.
Or just very sheltered, you know, because yeah, obviously he has benefited from generations of, you know, previous relatives having to sacrifice to make him this better life, right? Mm-hmm. So he had the best of the best, and he got to go away to America. And, you know, so even though he has a lot of pressure on his side, he didn't grow up poor the way that, you know, his father did, or definitely not the way his grandmother did. So it's kind of that. I mean, also, he was very well intentioned, right? Because he sees this family who needs money, and they were so hospitable to him, right? They let him into their home and, you know, shared a meal with him. And it was just very sweet of them to do that. And I think that was just his way of being, I don't know, thanking them for.
Right, right. No, of course. It's like, it's rooted in a good place again, but.
But money does not solve all problems. And I think.
No. And there's also a level of like, I mean, and in this, we've been talking about this a little bit, like this very like patriarchal culture where like you giving money to another man is like it's a matter of pride, right? Like, I didn't earn this money, so I'm not going to take this like freebie from you. So it's interesting to say the least. So at the end of the episode, he gets a call from Hannah, who he had obviously hadn't been able to find. And he's like, you need to come before it's too late. I don't want to die. Like, it's very, very dramatic. It's very worrying. And now, and you know, knowing Hannah from the little that we know, she's not the type to, like, the whole time she's been kind of like staying away and doesn't want to be found. And now for her to say, oh my God, you need to come find me, is like, obviously something's like seriously wrong. So, oh, and he also sees, like, he's walking through the city and he's like looking at like the first, the building construction sites and like who owns them. And he clearly is like trying to, something feels weird to him in the way of like who's in charge. And he tries to tell his American boss, who basically is like, whatever, I don't care about that. We're going to let you go. And your visa is, you should get a lawyer because there's going to be problems with your visa. So. Sorry, Solomon.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless, gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
When it comes to fitness, what's real? How about when it really truly fits your life? That's how Anytime Fitness sees it. Because our coaches see you. It's how they build personal plans that work wherever you are and focus on everything that matters, from fitness to nutrition to recovery. All so you can push yourself further than ever, or just through the next rep. It's total 360 support for a real difference. That's Anytime Fitness. That's real AF. Visit anytimefitness.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
That's episode 5, and we then go to episode 6, and we're flashing back to 1975, when Solomon and Hannah, when they were kids, very sweet to see them together, finally meeting Hannah, but she makes him shoplift, and they get in trouble right away.
Which is why Hannah is one of the worst people on the show. Even when she was little, she was not a good influence.
Yeah, and she's like owning him, or she walks up on him. She's like, good, I'm glad I made an appearance so those other girls know that you belong to me, or something like that. It's just, it's not great.
Daddy issues.
Yeah, right, seriously. Younger Sonja and her sister-in-law are coming back from, you know, we saw at the end of last episode that the husband was her Sonja's brother-in-law is mad at his wife and at Sonja that they, you know, everybody knows now, it got around like gossip that like they sold the watch to pay back the bill, and he's basically in his eyes been emasculated, and he's mad at her, and there's no calming him down. And Sonja's like, I don't know what to tell you, bro, like your wife was in trouble, there were these angry men who came, and I was just trying to help you out. But he doesn't want to hear it, and he goes to drink, and he gets really upset. And then this is when her water breaks.
Yes.
So it's not a good time for
no.
this. And her and Isaac comes home, but they send him to go find. Now, at first, I thought they were sending him to go find the husband to help, but then he goes, finds the husband, and just sits there and drinks with him.
Yosef, yeah. So he goes to find his brother because, well, first of all, what's he going to do if he sticks around for the childbirth?
Discover how women give birth. But yes, to your point, it's like, okay, this isn't for me. This isn't my lane. I'm not going to stay here. It makes sense. It makes sense. But I was misanticipating what the point of him going to find the brother was. But yes, to that point, she's pregnant, and for a long time they're just kind of standing there trying to deal with it themselves. It's very almost harrowing, and obviously, you know, women give birth all over the world in many different kinds of conditions, and freaking heroes as far as I'm concerned, but they don't really know what to do. She's never had a child before, the sister-in-law hasn't had a child, and they're rescued by the pig lady. Thank God the pig neighbor, who was being annoying in the other episode and her pigs were all around the alleyway, she comes and helps to deliver the baby. And she's asking for linens. We know from every TV show we've ever watched, you need the water and you need the clean linens or the towels or whatever it is. That's like the number one thing that whether it's a doula or like a midwife or whatever, if it's not in a hospital, you need those two things. That's like the number one and two things. I mean, would you agree with that?
I have not given birth, so I also
right,
don't know.
But you have experience watching.
That is what they taught me in health class. Yes, they said if you're ever gonna have a home birth, make sure you got those towels,
the
and
clean
the water.
Linens, right, and the water. But she's a hero, obviously, pig lady. So thank God that she was around. Pig neighbor, I should say. She's not a pig, but she owns pigs. That would be really strange if she were a pig herself. So, speaking of hospitals, though, Hannah is in the hospital in the future, and she has AIDS, unfortunately, which makes sense because of two reasons. It is one being it is the 80s, and two, she worked at a brothel. So unfortunately, it makes sense that she would have contracted probably HIV at some point, which has now turned into AIDS in the later stages. I'm happy to see her not in these conditions.
You mean the face behind the creepy phone calls?
Yes. But it seemed like she was just hiding under his desk for a while. But here we see that she actually was not hiding under his desk, as she was where she is now.
But they never explained. But even prior, they didn't really explain where she was calling him from.
Yeah, no, they don't explain that. And, you know, I guess it makes sense that, you know, on the one hand, we've seen word gets around really fast, but that was like the 30s and the 20s. So it's a little different now in the 80s, all the technology and stuff. But yeah, we don't know how she found out, but here she is. She has finally revealed herself. And now Solomon is there and, you know, Sunja shows up, older Sunja, and Hana's parents or Hana's mom comes to find her. So there's like a little bit of a reunion there, and everyone's really relieved to see her, even though obviously, you know, the situation is dire. She doesn't have a long time left, as we learn from the nurse and the doctors who come to see her. And at first, again, this is very 80s. The doctor was like, honestly, we don't feel comfortable having her here. You should take her away.
It's like COVID. No one wants to deal
with
it.
Yeah, exactly. Because we don't understand it, so we don't want to deal with it. Luckily, and this happened a lot, even here in America. I mean, no one is shocked to learn that. But, you know, for a while here, you know, it was like a disease that, you know, was for the most part affecting gay men, and everybody thought, oh, there was like a panic, and, you know, we don't want to treat them and blah, blah, blah. It's horrible. But there is thankfully a human doctor who is like, I will treat her. We'll put her in like a separate wing, you know, to keep her separate, whatever. But I volunteer as tribute, so to speak, to treat her. So thank God. But she's still, you know, having said all of that, she's no less sassy than the Hana that we have come to know both now in her current adult life and as a teenager. She's super sarcastic. She's super dry. A pretty entertaining character, even though I know you don't love her all that much, because she's a shit starter, so to speak.
She is. I'm like, what happened to you? Who hurt you?
I mean, we get a little bit of an insight here, but then again, we don't know that much who hurt her, because Solomon has to go. You know, he gets bored. He gets taken. He has to go to America to, you know, study and all that. So, you know, they don't get to have their cosmic love story. And then we get a scene which will, like, in and of itself, I didn't at the time, like, it didn't seem important, but Isaac meets this young kid when he's looking for, he's looking for his brother. And this is like when he starts to get like radicalized in a way, I guess, because the kid is telling him about like all the effort they put in and like they're being, you know, taken advantage of and subjugated in this way. And it seems like Isaac at first isn't into it, but he clearly has like, we'll see later on towards the end of the season that it has in fact struck a chord with him. And he is like listening to what this kid is saying. Okay, so in current times for Solomon as an adult, he, back in the 80s, he meets this guy who we will come to learn is the grandson of Hanzu, right? And he's, you know, Solomon doesn't want to... He's looking for a way out, right? Because he can't get back to America, seemingly, at least for now. He has been let go from his job, and he wants to talk to someone about the information that he had that he was trying to share with his boss, that he realized at the end of last episode with like the buildings and like the reality of what's happening. I mean, I don't understand real estate, but clearly there's money to be made and he knows how to make it. He has answers about how it's to be made in this particular instance. This guy seems kind of sketchy, but it feels like Solomon can trust him. How are you feeling about him? Or how were you feeling about him at that point anyway?
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously he grew up and had a close relationship with his grandfather, as he tells Solomon. So you can't ignore the fact, or, you know, kind of ignore the fact, yeah, that Solomon's family is telling him to be careful, because his dad, you know, even tells him that he shouldn't go into business with him because he knew his grandfather and knew what the type of person that he was.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, they have to get into it more, I think, get more into that backstory, because I know, I'm sure we'll get to this soon, but there's that whole episode. Episode 7 is dedicated to the whole backstory of Kohanzu and how he became the man that he is, that we've come to know.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't always that way, right? Obviously, something terrible happened that forced him to also go into survivor mode,
mm-hmm.
and do what he has to do to survive in this world. And I'm sure he raised his family to also be that way. I know he didn't have much of a relationship with his daughters, but apparently, you know, he was very involved and had a relationship with his grandson. So, you know, you can't really trust anyone these days. So
that's the takeaway. You can't find good help around here. I think that's a good point. I agree with that. I think clearly, even just the show, even before you like kind of realize who he is, the show is kind of giving you a sense that there are red flags here. You know, like this guy, you know, he doesn't seem to be lying to Solomon in any way, but you know, omission is also possible and seemingly prevalent here, of like, Solomon's not getting the whole story. But before the episode ends, old Sunja is, that sounds so rude to say it like that, but older Sunja is, you know, speaking of this stuff with Solomon and making money and trying to, like, you know, be and potentially get into business with this guy in some way, Sunja is telling him, you know, just as important as like making money is how you make money and how you came by your fortune and everything that you have in life. Like, all that stuff actually matters. It's not just, it's not just the ends justify the means. It doesn't, as far as she's concerned, they don't. So I think that was it's an interesting like juxtaposition of him kind of being presented somewhat in a way of like these two paths of like pure goodness versus potential like murky waters as far as the morality of making money. Back to young Sunja at the end of the episode, she has now given birth, thanks to the pig lady. And when the brother-in-law and when Sunja's brother-in-law and her husband come home, the baby's just born. Like, again, the men just get to come and like enjoy the spoils. Like, wow, we did it, everyone. We had the baby. We be included in the men. It's dumb. But there is actually this sweet moment, though, I thought of, like, because Sunja's brother-in-law, not her husband, is the elder sibling, he gets to choose the name of the baby. And, you know, he at least has the good sense to be like, oh, no, not me. Like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, no, you have to. It's kind of your, he's like, I can't, you know, he's like, I can't accept such an honor. And they're like, well, it's not really honor, it's your duty. So he calls him Noah, which I think is a sweet name.
Well, it's biblical.
Right. Yes, it is. So by that measurement, it is successful. It is successful in what they intended. I mean, yeah, and to your point, he even says it. He's like, we'll call him Noah because, you know, of Noah's Ark and, you know, starting life over and all that.
Right.
Stuff.
Yeah. So the meaning behind it is, you know, beautiful and, you know, gives a lot of hope for the family. But I agree that he had, I think he also kind of felt bad, right? Because he had been giving Sunja such a hard time since she got there. And then she said to him, you should name our baby, or my baby.
And I think there was a moment where he's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been so mean to her.
Yes. Yeah, no, I agree. There is a bit of a like, oh, okay, now I kind of feel like I was being a dick. And that is the end of episode 6. And to a previous point that we had made, episode 7, not only is it a different episode overall, it's different right from the get, because we talked about how this episode has no opening credits song. It's just like the card, the pachinko card, the title card that appears. And this episode is 100% Hanzu's origin story, in a sense. Like at the end of, we didn't mention it, but at the end of episodes 5 and 6, he appears just at the very end of both episodes. We find out like he was responsible for the pawn guy giving Sunja the 300 yen for the watch, and then he like bought it back from him. And then in the next episode, he, because he now has a son, which he has learned the news that his son was born, he is horrible to his wife, and he's like, okay, you are relieved of your conjugal duties. And I kept wondering to myself, like, why are we getting like two random quick moments of Hanzu at the end? Well, episode 7 answered my question. We are getting a whole Hanzu episode flashback.
Because in case you guys forgot, Lee Min-ho is one of the biggest stars in Asia, and he will not be a supporting
He will not be denied. Yeah, that is funny, because that's something that I thought of immediately. Like, oh, of course he's going to get an episode. If anyone's going to get an episode, because, you know, we need to keep the people entertained.
But and... you guys, also not in the book.
Right,
this whole backstory.
Okay.
But
I mean, I was just going to say, you know, this episode contains like they managed to like fold in a real life event. I mean, this has happened already in the show, but it takes place in really, I think, over just one entire day, which was September 1st, 1923, when an earthquake of 7.9 magnitude erupted in that region. And it's pretty scary to live through that. I mean, certainly to live through it, but like, it's scary for us to see. And you had said something interesting that I'll ask you to repeat here. I was like, well, why would they give him like a random you know, flashback episode, besides, you know, putting aside the Lee Min-ho of it all for a second?
Because up until now, Ko Hanzu was kind of the villain of the story, right? He, you know, he basically knocked her up and then was like, I can't marry you, but...
And wanted to have her, like, as a side piece. Yeah.
Yeah, like, but you can be my mistress and I'll buy you a house and you can raise my son, because also all he wants is a son, as most men at that time wanted. And, you know, he was very invested. And he even told his wife, right? You know, there's that scene where he tells his actual wife that he has a son now, and like, they no longer need to basically have sex because he's done with her.
Yeah.
So everything up until then, it's like, he's kind of a dick. And then you have this whole backstory and you realize he wasn't always this way. And there is always a pivotal moment in people's lives that turns them from good to evil. Well, not evil, but.
Yeah. And certainly that like shapes them, where it's like, okay, like, I think you were spot on as far as like making him sympathetic and like giving us just like making us understand his character more, his motivation. It retroactively colors in and makes us feel, whether it's positive or negative, makes us feel more emotion towards the character of Hanzu than we had been feeling previously. So in that sense, it's pretty effective. It's like a little mini spinoff. It's like a one episode spinoff show where it's like a different actor, and he's like a tutor, and he's helping this American family, really this American kid, very privileged, obviously very wealthy, and the day starts to go pretty south pretty quickly once the earthquake starts.
Yeah, and that's basically how he ends up becoming, this is what I assume is happening, right? Because his dad owed him, the gangster, a debt. And then his dad dies, so the guy's basically like, you have to pay off your father's debt. And then he ends up adopting him, right? And then marries him off to his daughter, et cetera, et cetera. But
right. You're getting a little ahead. But
yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, sorry. But
you're right. But you're right in that, like, by the end of the episode, you know, so like his dad had owed money to this one guy, and there was a, right before the earthquake, it was possible that Hanzu was going to be traveling to America as this like young kid's tutor, this young white kid, I should say, who's about to go to Yale, but is stupid and needs this tutor. You know, you're not stupid if you need a tutor, but he happens to actually just be stupid according to everybody else around him. And, you know, his dad was like, you should go, there's a future for you. Then you find out that his dad owes all this money to this gangster type, and you know, then the earthquake happens, and basically through plot machinations, when the earthquake hits, Hanzu and his dad are at the gangster's like lair, for lack of a better word, hideout, whatever thing, and the father dies there, and they kind of like have to help each other, and he helps like Hanzu like escape because there's all this horrible killing of Korean people that like the Japanese are taking advantage of the mess from the earthquake. And by the end, there is like a sweet moment where, like, to your point, the guy who Hanzu is now like indebted to, he's like, oh, your dad still owes me the debt, so you should come with us. But it's not really about the debt. It's that they went through like this crazy ordeal and this like insane experience, and now they've kind of bonded and they can just be real with each other. And to your point, yeah, I think this is exactly how, you know, we've seen what adult Hanzu grows up to be. And here we're seeing like the origins of how he got access to any money, because clearly when he was growing up, they didn't have a lot of money.
And he went through such a traumatic experience, I feel like, all in one day, you know, because you have the earthquake, and then he has to hide in that carriage and watch all these Korean escapees from the prison get burned alive in this barn. And then, you know, there's that moment, right, where the family's sleeping and he kind of gets up and looks out and he sees kind of the smoke from, I'm assuming, where, you know, the barn was burning. And you can, you know, there's that moment with his face, right? And his expression changes and you're like, oh, like this is where when it happened.
Right.
This is exactly when he like turned the switch.
When he like hardened. Yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
He's like, I need to be, you know, in the later episode, you know, where he talks to young Noah, you know, he says, you have to be better than everybody else, so they're forced to respect you. You know, and I think that's where it ends up driving him to be this person, because he's also a survivor.
Right, right. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And again, whether you sympathize with him or not, the episode does a good job, as we said already, of like giving you, like explaining his motivations in a way that feels earned and is actually kind of interesting. And I was not expecting that. And then the episode does just have like a couple of cards at the end of it addressing like the real life earthquake that again happened in 1923. And I mentioned like the horrible killing of innocent Koreans who were, according to the show, scapegoated for the devastations afterward by Japanese vigilantes. The exact number of Koreans murdered is disputed, but historians agree that it is in the thousands. It's upsetting stuff, but I appreciate that the show is not just showing us an upsetting thing that happened to actually exist in history, but like they're also letting you know, like they're trying to teach you this historical lesson, because they know that, I mean, this is an international show, but they know that a lot of, you know, not so educated Americans have no idea about this kind of stuff. So then we get to the finale, episode 8. And, you know, early on, we learn that young Sunja and her son Musasu, who is not Noah, which is worth noting. So early on, young Sunja now has Noah, who's a little bit older. He's like a young kid. And then there's Musasu, who we have met in the future, who is her youngest that she had. He's just a little baby. He's about to turn one year old, we find out at the end. And all of a sudden, young little Noah comes running and he's like, I waited for dad an hour and he never came. And that's weird because clearly he never misses a school pickup, so to speak. And Sunja is obviously concerned for good reason. And basically they find out that he had been arrested because of, you know, political reasons, that there was talk and chatter that he potentially was like transmitting messages of dissent, you know, against the Japanese. And, you know, we called out that earlier moment where that kid kind of calls attention, kind of radicalizes Isak in this way of like, you know, you're not thinking of things in the way they actually are. And clearly that got to him and now he's in trouble. So Hana is dying, which isn't great. It's getting like more and more bleak, and it seems like it's like imminent that she is like on the brink of death. Her and Solomon have this conversation where she's basically like, don't let them give you shit. Like, don't let them treat you like crap the way they have already been, and like take what's yours and don't be meek, you know, don't be meek. She's kind of trying to like give him life advice in a way, because obviously she's not going to be around for much longer. And she kind, you know, speaking of radicalizing, she's kind of radicalizing Solomon a little bit in this way here, where she's like trying to activate him, like shake him out of his stupor a little bit, where it's like, yo, stop following the rules, stop doing what they tell you to do, and just do what you want to do, which is kind of good advice.
You know what, Hana, look where that got you in life. Let's just leave poor Solomon alone.
Oh, no, Hana, oh, I miss her already. I mean, she wants her to be happy. She lived a full life. She may be dying a horrible death, but she had fun. She would say, at least in her opinion, which is of course to her the only opinion that matters, that she has lived a full life, and that she burned bright. What is it? She burned bright and fast and hot, whatever, you know, where like the candle goes out in a blaze of glory, so to speak. So that's a pretty sweet moment. So Sunja and her small son Noah are basically on the case of like running around trying to find where the dad is being kept, if they can talk to him. Obviously, if they can get him out, they end up at the police station where they meet a woman whose husband has been in jail for like 3 months, or relative. I don't remember if it's her husband, it might be her brother or something. But clearly that's a horrible sign that he's been in there for 3 months, because, you know, her husband has been in there only a day, and it seems like it's going to be a lot longer than a day. There was a moment where they're talking to, I think, people from the congregation, if I'm remembering correctly, where she is speaking Korean and her little son Noah, who, I mean, how old would you say he is here? He's probably only like, what, 8 years old?
I think like, he's seven.
Seven? Okay, yeah. That makes sense. I had a very, very relatable, or I felt this so hard, I guess is what I'm saying, of like, your parent is, you have to translate for your parent to this other party, but you're like so much, very much a child still. Like, not, it's kind of like you're being the adult in this moment, right? And like something is being asked of you kind of beyond your years. And for me, this hit really hard of just like, it was both like sweet and sad in a way of like, you know, there's that like loss of innocence that happens. And he's, you know, he's just a carefree kid as far as, I mean, you know, with the dad thing aside for a second, in general, having to translate for his parents isn't a bad thing. But this is like an emotion. It does take a toll on you to have to like rise to that occasion and kind of be way more mature than you would normally be at that age in that moment. I'm sure you had similar experiences.
I mean, I think you and I are both having still those experiences, no?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, yeah, at least now we're older and we're able to, we could say maybe, you know, it doesn't like affect us as much, but even being in school, I mean, I think I remember talking about this last time, but I've talked about it a lot. Like parent-teacher conferences was always a trip because when the news was bad, you can't really lie about like facial expressions. And there's a lot of nonverbal communication that is coming off the teacher in that case. There's also your grade. So, you know, there's only so much lying you can do. But whenever possible, if the news is bad, try to like soften the blow a little bit in my translation or leave certain details out. You know, try to use it to my advantage when possible.
How very Kohansu of you to manipulate the situation in your favor.
Oh God. I know. I should have tried to sell them a watch of some kind. Or try to get some money back for it.
Bribe them with a watch.
Bribe them, yes, thank you. So yeah, so we get a moment, speaking of the watch and speaking of the original owner of the watch, after there's a moment where Hanzu appears and just approaches his son in the middle of the street, like very brazen, very like out in the open. And he is dressed very well. Like he's the kind of person who's going to stick out in a crowd, literally.
That's because he's in the Yakuza.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised to learn that. Just, you know, we haven't heard the name yet as far as like within his character being involved in that, but it makes a lot of sense. And he talks to him, right? And he gives him some advice. He's kind of like, don't go. He's like taking a route to school and he's like, why are you taking this route? And it's because his father used to like going that way, but it's a longer way. And he's kind of like, be more efficient, you know, take the real way that, you know, take the more direct way. It's kind of stupid. It's kind of like, of all things,
what he really means is I'm your father.
Yes, that is for sure what he is putting down, even if Noah is not quite picking it up yet. And it does seem like that kind of thing where he's gonna start like appearing to him more. Like that was just the sense that I got. If he's like, oh, this is our first time meeting, but it won't be our last, and like he's trying to get closer to his son. That's my theory anyway. I mean, you know, don't say if it's true, but
I can neither confirm nor deny. But don't you feel like the timing's very interesting that he said after all these years he mm-hmm. appears the moment that Isaac goes to prison and he just swoops in there?
Yes, I mean, there is the issue of, you know, going back to Noah's adoptive father, Sunja's actual husband, there's a moment where someone's like, the fact that they like were looking for your husband specifically means that he was named by someone. And of course, if you're paying attention, the person you immediately think of, or certainly one of the people you immediately think of, is Hanzu. Like, he clearly did something shady. We saw him keeping tabs on her via the watch, and he knows that a son was born. He has little, you know, he's like Varys, right? In Game of Thrones, he must have little birds everywhere. They whisper to him. So yes, absolutely. He clearly, unfortunately, and it's like horrible now to like say it out loud. Like for me personally, it's very sad, but like he manufactured basically the dad getting out of the picture so that he could swoop in. And to your point, years later, when the kid can like now understand him a little more, it's not like he waited for the kid to have better communication skills so that he could, you know, talk to him and like fool him into feeling a certain way, as opposed to like coming in and stealing him or whatever.
Right, because he's at a very impressionable age. He's vulnerable. Also very cute. Little Noah is very cute.
He is adorable. That little haircut and just like in general, his personality, he's so sweet. He's such a good kid. He follows his mom's direction. He goes straight to the factory to get his uncle, right? To, you know, get help. And then, you know, speaking of the uncle, poor uncle, who just like takes off work to try to go help or try to go find where his brother is. And then in the end, they find out that, you know, he was arrested for like those political reasons. And when his brother finds out, or when the boss finds out that his brother was arrested for political reasons, he's like, ooh, I can't be associated with you. Therefore, you're fired. That's really messed up. I felt so bad. Like another thing of all, like first the brother is in prison because of damn Hansu. And now he doesn't even have a job. That's really sad.
I don't like him, so
it's okay. Right, you had a problem with the brother. But think about how it's affecting Sunja and the son. I mean, you're right. But which is why, speaking of, he loses that job. And so just like, listen, I gotta make this kimchi so that I can sell it in the market. And he has the nerve, to your point about him being not great, he has the nerve to be like, hey. You're selling stuff? What about me? I'm the man. And so just like, well, you don't have a job. We're about to run out of money. Like, I'm a member of this household too. I would like to contribute.
Well, that's why the pride thing is so dumb, because he would rather have his family starve until he gets a job. And she's more like, no, I'm going to figure out a way for us to survive and make money because I have two children that I need to take care of and feed.
Yeah, it's a moment of frustration, certainly. But we know from our experience with Sunja that she is not going to take no for an answer. She's going to be like, that's cool. I hear you. Bye. Like, I'm just going to do it anyway. And even her sister-in-law joins her to help because she knows that she's absolutely right. And like, yes, there is a little bit of like Sunja rubbing off on her, right? Like she was envious of her before. But here it's like, yeah, you're right. Let's make this kimchi. Also, that kimchi looks delicious, I will just say. I'm a fan. I trust them. I'm sure it was great. And she's selling it in the marketplace. And back to the future time, Hana is, you know, circling the drain. And she had spoken to Solomon previously and was like, you know, one of the places I really want to go to is Hawaii. And he takes her, at this point she's like dying, right? Like she's like, it seems like she has, I don't know, minutes left or like hours. So he takes her bed and he runs her through the hall like at full sprint, which is like really sweet, right? Like on the one hand, yeah, it's dangerous, but on the other hand, like she's dying. Like he wants to make her feel something. Like she has so much morphine in her system. You know, they kind of like show her point of view a little bit, like it's like, you know, like cloudy, her vision. And he brings her up to the roof and he puts, you know, to feel some fresh air, which I'm sure is nice. And he puts a lei on her, a Hawaiian lei. And he's like, look, you're in Hawaii now.
That's when the waterworks start, because if you're someone watching this scene, you just lose it, right?
That's when my waterworks started, for sure. One of the times. And it's just so sweet that he did this for her, that he was able to do this for her, and the family's there and they're all sad. And, you know, she got to have like the closest thing to a peaceful death in her condition that she could have. And she got like one final wish, in a sense. He was able to do that kindness for her, which is very, very, very beautiful. And like, cannot be understated how sweet and important that is. And there's a scene where we see older Sunja give Solomon the watch back, and they don't solve this mystery in this episode. So this is clearly one of those like hanging threads for future season, because the last time we saw the watch, it was given to, you know, Hansu was buying it back from the pawn guy that young Sunja had sold it to. And now, mysteriously, here it is back in her possession. And she says, I used to think that this was a curse, but now I know that it's, you know, I don't think she calls it a blessing, but she's like, it's something for our family to have, like it protects us or whatever. And actually, I just remember that that kind of harkens back to something that her dad had said when she was a little girl, when he was like, I used to think that I was cursed. I mean, it's not one to one, but it reminded me of it. I used to think that I was cursed until you all came into my life. So I like that there's a little bit of a callback to her dad there. And the other hanging thread that we see or that we learn here is how Noah died, because, you know, when Noah, the little kid, is talking to his biological father, Hansu, and then later on, he's like running through the street after he has to say goodbye to his dad. And I was like, oh my God, is this where he dies? Like, you keep thinking like something bad is going to happen to him. And then it doesn't. And then you're like, wait, how did he? Because there is a mention earlier that he's not around. So I guess this is another mystery to be solved.
Unless you read the book, but yes.
Oh my God. No, don't tell me. So you already know.
Yeah. But, you know, this. Now I'm having this issue where it's, do I not read the book now until the show's over?
Until the show's over, yeah.
I didn't think it was going to come back for a second season.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there's enough there.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, no, he, you know, because also remember when he was a baby, you know, the, it's not a game, but, you know, when they turn one, they lay out all those random miscellaneous objects on the table, and whatever the baby grabs at is kind of the foretelling of what his future will be. And so they said for Noah, he grabbed the red string, which means that he was going to live a long life.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
So he's definitely not going to get, you know, run over by a pig when he's 7 years old. I think he's still got a ways to go before whatever happens right. to him happens.
That's true, because there's so much time between the last we saw of him and how old Sanja and her other son are now.
Yeah, so like quote unquote present day. It's right. literally 40, I don't know, 30 years maybe, 30, mm-hmm. 40.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
a lot, you know, he can, you know, anything could have happened to him. He could still be alive for all we know.
Mm-hmm. No, it's crazy. Oh my God, he was living with Hana. No, he was in that pretend place where she was hiding. I love that they set up, because I wasn't expecting, like, to me, this wasn't a show. I mean, and it's stupid to say out loud, right? Because any show, regardless of what genre the show is capable of having like cliffhangers and mysteries set up for future season. But I wasn't expecting to have like such obvious hanging threads of like, wait, they didn't tell us. Oh my God. So I'm actually like excited and like pleasantly surprised. And you know, the final scene that we see is once again, Sanja being a badass and like going to market, having no experience, but looking around her, and like we literally see her kind of absorb all this information and be like, I'm a saleswoman. And I think the last line is like, this is the food of my country, or, you know, this is a dish, and something along those lines, because she's selling the kimchi. And then it goes up into the clouds. And one thing I do want to call out, that's the end of the episode. One thing I do want to call out is like the word endured kept coming up. Like, I'm not, you know, I know sometimes they play fast and loose with translations in the subtitles and stuff, but in the very beginning of the episode, or excuse me, in the very beginning of the season, we got like that prophecy, right? When Sanja's mother went to that shaman-esque type figure and was like, you know, we've had like several miscarriages. We need good news, basically. And the figure's like, yes, this child will be born and give and, you know, have multiple generations spawn from them. And through this, your family will endure. And throughout these last episodes, especially, the word endure has come up at least once, where it's like people enduring things, both usually negative, obviously. And it's such a powerful word. And it's such a specific word, the connotation of it. And I love that where the episode ends, again, teaching, like, or the story wise, I already said where the episode ended. But again, here we get another like post credits message from the show of like, I'm just going to read a couple of things. Over 2 million Koreans moved to Japan during colonial rule. About 800,000 of them were brought over by the Japanese government as laborers. The majority returned to their homeland at the end of World War II, but about 600,000 remained and became a stateless people. And then these are the stories of some of those women, not people, some of those women specifically. And then it says they endured. And I just thought that was so beautiful that the show, again, is like not just presenting us with a fictional story, but like trying to teach people about real events. And these women are still alive. And here is where I lost it again, like to see these women talk about their experience, these real life women, to be clear. These are not actresses. Everything that they went through and how like this show could in this very small way at least be kind of like a living memorial to their experiences, I thought was like really beautiful. And I don't know, I appreciated it.
Nothing more touching than little old Asian ladies.
Little old Asian ladies, and they all look so sweet and cute, and just like, I just wanted to give them a hug. And like, again, to share so much of, especially in the generations that they came from, where like to share that kind of stuff, clearly we see is like somewhat frowned upon culturally. To see them have endured after so long and share their stories here is really beautiful. And again, I commend the show, even though it's like run by an evil corporation, Apple. I commend the show for there are layers to these things. I commend the show itself and everyone involved for ending the season that way, right? And like you could make the argument that they're kind of taking a little bit of the shine away from the show proper, but they would clearly argue this is more important than that, right? Of like the enduring of the real people that inspired the story.
Do you feel like this show, one of the themes of the show was female empowerment? Do you feel like they portrayed women in a positive light?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, there are very few people on the show are perfect. Obviously, you know, you can make the argument, no one is perfect, but to the point of enduring, the majority of the people who we saw enduring these things, and I think it's no coincidence that the real life people that we meet at the end are women. The brunt of the enduring falls on the women who are like, in some cases, physically enduring like a child, right? Child labor, like they're carrying the children, whatever. But they're enduring the majority of the trauma because the men are either completely out of the picture or getting drunk at a bar, avoiding things, or dead, you know? So it's actually like, if not female empowerment, certainly like women having to shoulder the burden because there is no other option. And, you know, I guess empowerment in that sense, I think so for sure is the answer. And I think that's a beautiful thing to see. Obviously, you know, something we could use more of in the world as far as stories being told.
Do you feel like this show, well, it's not just a show, right? Because it's a reflection of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interpretation of the book. But obviously, Japan and Japanese people are not really portrayed in the most positive light. Do you feel like the story is very anti-Japanese?
I think I'd love to hear your opinion and the answer to this question. But I feel like the show is pretty fair. Like the show, for the most part, seems to be pretty factual. And it's not like a value judgment, or not a value judgment in the sense of like, it's no one particular person's fault. However, the people in that society were making choices, right? Like the Japanese people, some of them behaving really badly, some of them like doing awful, horrendous things, like literally killing Korean people. So I don't think, I would say again, the show is very fair. Like, they're not trying to gloss over anything. Like, all these horrible things really happened, and it's important for people to know so that these things don't get forgotten. I think that's true of any country, right? Of like, even, you know, certainly here in America, where it's like, oh, we're going to gloss over some horrible things in our history. Like, no, we need to like own up to those things so that we don't do things like that again. But I don't think it's like anti-Japanese. I think it's very pro-Korean and very like pro-Korean story, where the story is most important. But I think you would kind of have a hard time saying that it's like just straight up anti-Japanese.
I'm trying to remember if there was anyone who was Japanese who was not portrayed as a, not a villain, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
as a good person.
I mean, there are people that helped them along the way, but I'm trying to remember if, yeah, if a lot of those people were like other Koreans living in Japan. That's a good question. Yeah, there might be a couple we're not thinking of, but I think you're absolutely right that for the most part, the answer is no. But again, I think even to that point, right, like they don't present any like quote unquote Japanese hero, but it doesn't feel inherently anti-Japan. It's more inherently like anti these specific Japanese policies and the way that like that like giant swath of history kind of treated the Korean people. It's certainly not pulling punches in that regard, I don't think. But it's pretty interesting, because I will admit, again, being from this country, and there are some short, you know, growing up in this country, certainly, and there are some shortcomings as far as like historical teachings. I didn't really know a whole lot about this, and I'm not surprised that I didn't know about this, but I am and certainly happy to have learned about it, but I can't believe it's as the scope of it is as big as it was at the time. It's crazy to consider.
Yeah, you realize, oh, there's so much we don't know, because it's natural to just teach your people, your country, about your history and not about stuff that's going on in other countries or other parts of the world. Like, I remember when I was younger, I don't know if this is true because I didn't grow up in the South. So anyone who actually did grow up in the South and, you know, had history class, I would love to hear their interpretation of how like the Civil War actually played out and who actually won the war. You know, but even within the same country, right? You can have different perspectives, different interpretations of the same event written in your favor to make you not seem as bad as maybe you were.
Yeah, right. No, I agree with that.
But yeah, same. Like, I didn't know this was as bad. I mean, obviously, I feel like my mom, you know, knew about this and growing up, like, learned about this, you know, her family relatives lived through this.
Right.
And it's terrible, you know, humans treating other humans and like they're not, you know, just racism, discrimination, you know, all of that stuff is just terrible. And, you know, it's just kind of like sad to watch it go down, even if it is fiction,
because
based on reality.
Because it's all based on reality. But I do appreciate that there was even amongst all that, there were genuinely sweet moments, moments of grace, moments, you know, of happiness. And to end on a somewhat hopeful note, you know, the historical stuff aside, the hopeful note of like Sunja is enduring again, to go back to the, to beat that dead horse. She, you know, is selling the kimchi, and clearly it's going to be somewhat successful. And, you know, she finds a way, and it's beautiful to see. That's what, you know, going back to the opening credits, that's what I appreciate. It's like the moments of joy and the moments of hope and the moments of transcending the sadness become that much more important, because they're kind of fleeting. And I think the show does a good job of like giving us just enough, some would argue not enough, but just enough. I wouldn't just enough, of those kinds of moments to balance it out. Is there anything else you think we should discuss about the season before we wrap up? I think we've covered almost everything.
Oh, for this season? Let's see.
Yeah, or speculation of next season, I guess.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. What are your hopes and dreams for season two?
I guess I would, I don't know. On the one hand, I think it would be annoying to like see Solomon in America. On the other hand, I think it would be like an experience that I would relate to, you know, a little bit of like being, you know, being from somewhere that you're living somewhere that you're not from and like your parents are from somewhere else and like what that's like. I hope. Oh, no more Hana. But maybe we can get, I think you made this point before, maybe we can get, you know, we're not going to get adult Hana, but maybe we get some more Hana when they were kids. That would be cool. More Sun. I mean, we can't get more Sunja, but as long as we keep focused on Sunja, and I'm worried. Okay, one thing I'll say is like, I'm worried now about Hansu's involvement in Noah's life and potentially being involved in how Noah ends up dying, however that happens. Like, you know, we haven't heard, as far as I can remember, we haven't heard older Sunja reference Hansu as far as like being the father and how she feels about him, you know, like that dirtbag or anything like that. So I just wonder how his death, how Noah's death will factor into Sunja's greater story and how the hell she got that watch back. I really want to know.
The watch thing, yes. That mm-hmm. will definitely be something I'm sure will play a big part. I don't know. I mean, it definitely alludes to the fact that they are reunited at some point, right? So
yeah, in some way, even if it's only a conversation.
And she has kept it this long after all these years.
Right. That's the bigger point, that she still has it. That's like the crazy thing to consider.
Yeah. So maybe they'll reconcile. I mean, who knows? But I mean, obviously Hansu has made his presence known to Noah, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Shots fired, so to speak.
Yeah. So he's like, I'm here now. And, mm-hmm. you know, he will, I'm sure he won't just disappear again because he knows right. where, you know, they are now. Mm-hmm. But there'll definitely be more of Sunja season two, because if they start getting into Noah growing up, his brother, like she is still there as their mother. And, you know, in the book, like that is in a whole section. That's a whole, it's a book within the book, you know, it's a whole part Ooh. Of the, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right.
So, and that part is very interesting, I thought, you know, at least mm-hmm. from the book.
Right.
And, you know, you have Noah and Mzazu, who are very different. You know, they're brothers, different fathers, very different personalities.
Right, right, right.
So it'll be interesting to see that play out. Also very curious who they're going to cast as Ooh. The brothers.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
they get older.
Maybe, also, maybe they'll just have Lee Min Ho play like multiple roles.
All of them. well, also curious to see if the original cast will come back for a season two. Because
right, there might be certain time periods that they show less of or don't show, you know, so that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right. Like, I don't think any version of Sunja is going anywhere.
Do you think they're going to recast her? Because she's technically kind of teen, young adult Sunja.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I guess theoretically, like if we're going to get like that actress could pay like 20s, even 30s. But then we start to get into like 40s. We're going to need to recast probably.
It's like The Crown. Every
yes,
season,
exactly. Oh my God. Does that mean that Olivia Colman will be playing a role?
She will be playing middle-aged Sunja.
Middle-aged Sunja. Oh no, please not that. On that note, I think we are all clear. We have endured enough here. Listeners have endured us enough now listening to us talk about this. Soon, thank you so much, seriously, for coming on and talking about this and sharing your experience. This was, I said this last time, but this is such a joy for me, genuinely, personally, getting to do this with you. I hope that you had as much fun as I did.
It was definitely an experience, for sure. Mm-hmm. Thank you for inviting me. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope you will invite me back for season two. Because
yes,
it would
maybe
be
next year.
Fun to do that again. But yes. No, I had a lot of fun. And I hope everyone will read the book after this.
Yeah, yeah, a strong recommendation for the book here.
Read the book, guys.
So, I mean, at some point, I might have to read the book. And to your point, I'm not sure which I'm going to do first. Or, you know, if I'm going to start reading the book before I finish the show. But I guess I will see. So, I am on Twitter, at that other Ariel, if anybody wants to reach out. Other things being covered here on Push Show Recaps, I am covering The Wilds with Jess and Grace. We are deep into season two now. There are daily pods being released on the Bin Show Recaps feed. Also covering movies every week with Grace. We just covered Ambulance this week. And so that has already been released. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Oh, yes. And I'm also covering The Staircase with Marissa, brand new HBO Max limited series based on the horrific true crime, allegedly. So look out for that. Those three episodes are out of the show, and the first pod or two are out, and then the episodes on HBO Max will be going weekly, starting with episode 4. So do look out for that. I think that's everything for me. Soon, thank you again so much. And if you're still listening, we appreciate you so much for doing so. We will catch you in season 2. Bye-bye.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.